Welcome, everybody. Make sure you've got enough cushions to be comfortable. And, you know, do move if you need to. You don't need to sit really still for a talk. So my name's Sudhajaya, and I've been ordained nearly 13 years now. And my name means she who is difficult for Mara to conquer. So that means it's difficult for things to get in my way. Now, what I'll illustrate with this talk is it is difficult, but you know, Buddhism gives us the tools to work with things. Yeah. So my name is the name of a bodhisattva, and we're given our order names to aspire to something. It's not what we are at the moment. Okay. So what I'd like to do first is just get some of your ideas of what you would consider happiness. If you could call them out, and I'll just write them up here. I just want to see sort of where your thinking is. Anyone start?
Being content.
Being content.
Mm-hmm. Feeling peaceful.
Peaceful. So the person right behind you is too. Yeah. Peaceful. Yeah, just behind.
Feeling grateful.
Grateful.
Feeling fulfilled.
Fulfilled.
Satisfied.
Satisfied.
Lovely.
Free from worries.
Yeah. Be calm. Or you've realised that doesn't make you terribly happy.
Inspiration.
Big one, isn't it? And I'll put health here as well.
Love. Seeing other people happy.
Seeing other people happy. Integrated, yeah. You sort of mean emotionally.
But I actually mean that, like feeling part of a community.
Ah, okay. So I'll put being effective. You mean sort of effective in a role? Yeah.
I suppose one would say you don't need a role, so like, I'm happy to
Oh no, I think you do.
Okay. Yeah? Stability.
Stability. Okay.
Good friend.
Sorry, I can't see you. Yeah.
Good friends,
yeah. So you can probably see what I've done. These are sort of more internal things, and these are more things that depend more on other people. But we need them all, don't we? So that's great. So funnily enough, I've probably had probably relatively one of the unhappiest weeks that I've had for a long time. So it's been quite timely to be doing this talk. And I'll, as I go through, I'll tell you what happened. But so we've sort of got inner and more outer states of happiness. So interestingly enough, the definition or the root of the English word happiness comes from Icelandic, which is hap. And that means luck or coming out of the blue, which is quite interesting because later on I'll talk about the Buddhist definition of happiness. It was a bit like, you know, well, is it something we expect to happen to us? Are we surprised? Yes? And so the gist of my talk is really that we create it ourselves, no matter what the circumstances. So research in psychology shows that unhappy people tend to be focused on themselves, and they may have very good reason to be unhappy. It's not a judgment. They tend to regard problems as happening to them, and they then feel powerless to do anything about it. Unhappy people tend to see events and other people as more and more disturbing. It's like they get into a bit of a habit of seeing things aren't the way they want. Unhappy people habitually identify more and more things as a problem. And then, if you're identifying most things as a problem, it becomes very difficult to experience pleasure. And then the research in psychology that they've done on people that would describe themselves as happy, which is, I think, a lot of what you're saying here, tend to be more willing to reach out and help others. They tend to be more loving and forgiving, a bit more open, and tend to be more sociable, flexible, creative, and able to tolerate life's daily frustrations. Does that sort of ring true in your experience? Not necessarily of yourselves, because we are unhappy at times, you know. Yeah. And it actually is relatively new research because psychology's tended to, you know, historically concentrated on the problems and identifying the problems. And, you know, it's flipped a bit. So I'm not an expert. So, and the research in neuroscience, well, actually, the question I ask myself is, okay, happy people are a certain way. Are they like this because they're already happy? And I don't know whether you know about the neuroscientific research that's shown there's a specific area in the brain, I think it's about here, the left prefrontal cortex, that lights up on an MRI scan when people are feeling happy. And a person called Dr. Richard Davison, did all these studies, and he looked at ordinary people and Tibetan monks. And the Tibetan monks were meditating on compassion. And the part of the brain they started to call the happiness center
lit up by a huge margin compared to ordinary people. And they're actually meditating on loving kindness and compassion. And what they did is they got a baseline for ordinary people that did describe themselves as being happy. And they sort of got a baseline sort of light up. And then they asked them to perform 5 acts of kindness over a week and did the MRI scan a week later. And it led to an increase of activity in the happiness centre. So it sort of began to prove, like the Dalai Lama says, that loving kindness and compassion tend to make us happier. We're not loving and kind because we're happy. So, very interesting. So, the Dalai Lama says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want yourself to be happy, practice compassion. So why? Why is that the case? So it tends to help us see inside our own, outside our own particular needs and wants. Happy people tend to be looking very inward. So it helps us expand. And how do we get there? Well, there are lots of meditation and mindfulness practices that we can do, especially those which cultivate loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And when we practice doing those meditations and ways of being, it tends to smooth our pendulum of emotions. They tend to sort of, when you know, the word integrated, yeah? You meant something a little bit different, but integrated emotions sort of mean that you're not really high, not really low. You sort of tend to balance around the middle, but you still have the passion, yeah? You still have it. And can bounce back, perhaps from a disappointment, because we're all disappointed at times. Things will always happen to us that we don't expect and upset us. But working on our minds in this way helps us cope better with those sorts of things. So, when the unexpected happens, we feel unhappy. So Sangharakshita, who's the founder of the Triratna Order, said, if one is unhappy, one wants to know the reason why. It never occurs to us to ask why we're happy. It's therefore unhappiness rather than happiness that causes us to reflect on our condition. That's interesting, isn't it? So my sort of downer in the week was I wasn't shortlisted for a job that I absolutely expected to be shortlisted for. And I was surprised how much all of a sudden, I can't do this, I'm going along the wrong track, I'm wasting my money, all these things, really quickly. So I've spent a lot of time training my mind. And even though I felt horrible, I sort of knew there were things I could do. Yeah? So one of the techniques is to see unhappiness, disappointment, problems as a teaching. Okay, this has happened. What can I learn from it? What can I learn from myself? Rather than putting it out there. You know, they don't know what they're doing. They're mad. And that involves reflection. So, you know, was I taking this rejection too personally? Are there conditions around that job that I didn't fulfill, but I can't change anything in me to fulfill them? Like a very high qualification expected. Have I interpreted, you know, what was being asked correctly? You know, so could I have made a better application? No, I don't think so. And the main thing that I did was I rang up some friends and said, you know, what do you think? And they sort of could put it into a bit more objectivity. There are millions of people out there applying for these jobs, and you don't know who else is on the list, and you don't know the level of qualifications and experience you're up against. So I can't do anything more about my experience, except get more in time. But I started to feel, okay, there's a bigger picture I didn't know about, and I did misinterpret my expectation of getting this interview. You know, in my mind, I'd said, well, okay, they're only going to get this much and I'll get an interview. So, you know, I'd started off with the wrong expectation. And the really important thing, even though it's sort of painful, is just feel what it's like. You know, not rush off and do something different, and, you know, do what you're doing well, but also feel the down, feel the sadness. And you see it changing. So that reminds you of the Buddhist principle of impermanence. Nothing stays the same. So interestingly enough, connected with that, there's been research done on resilience and well-being. And that shows that humans of all ages need 5 positive experiences to balance out 1 negative experience. Yeah? Now, not a lot of people get that, do they? So I then, that helped me sort of understand why I felt so terrible, even though there were lots of things in the week, lots of positive reinforcement I was getting from the job I was already in. But that one experience sort of tipped over, and then a few nice things happened and it balanced out a little bit, like I found things I'd lost and stuff like that. Very simple things. I found my jelly under the cupboard. So, but think about your relationships, especially when they involve a power relationship. So with children, or as a teacher, a parent, supervisor or carer of adults. You know, do we really, in terms of our relationships with people, give 5 experiences, 5 positive experiences, or 5 positive affirmations, yeah, for every 1 negative thing we might have to say? Think of the little child. I've worked in early years for years, that can't cope in the classroom. He probably gets told off 3 or 4 times a day. He's not going to get 15 to 20 positive affirmations. So his self-esteem, well-being, is going to do that. Or she. Yeah? So it's something to think about. But, so what can we do as adults? What we can do is learn to use our minds and control our minds and work with our minds very effectively. So that leads us to the second noble truth. Because, you know, why do we suffer? Yeah? The origin of suffering is craving or desire. So I desired an interview for this job. You know, that desire was the suffering. And Sangharakshita says something really interesting. I hadn't seen this before. I found it so interesting. It's almost like the proof of that second noble truth. The happiness you feel when you satisfy a desire is not due to the satisfaction of the desire, but the momentary cessation of that desire. Isn't that amazing? Shall I say it again? The happiness you feel when you satisfy a desire is not due to the satisfaction of the desire, but the momentary cessation of that desire. So if we don't have that root desire, we're happy. So that's quite something, isn't it? And we can all think of our own examples where we've got something we've wanted and we're happy for a little while, and then, boop, we're not so happy anymore.
Excuse me, I could ask you something.
momentous, is that addiction? Is that?
Sorry, momentary.
That and the other word that went with that.
Cessation.
Is that addiction?
Well, yes, sort of addiction. Addiction can be a desire that, you know, sort of like wrought really large, isn't it? Yeah, because there's craving, you know, a craving sort of, perhaps a better word for it, but yeah. So, you know, so it makes us realise most of the time we are in a state of desiring something, and that helps us move forward. It's not a bad thing, but we have to see it for what it is and really be aware of when it lays us low. So, in a way, that sort of supports, you know, why feelings of rejection feel much more dominant than happy feelings. You know, it's why we start to think about it, why we start to explore it. Because it's strong, because desire is such a root in ourselves. You know, when that gets frustrated, it's, you know, it's really churning. But what we can do as practitioners is we can cultivate contentment. So our desires then don't become so strong.
So what drives us then to do things?
Well, I think desire does drive us to do things. It's not a bad thing.
But when it ceases, what drives us to still...
Shall we look at it a bit later? Because we've got 20 minutes for questions. Okay. Yeah, it's a good question. So, the definition of happiness in Buddhism is sukha, or bliss. And bliss is one of the positive elements of the spiral path towards enlightenment. So feelings of bliss can actually change you a lot. And if we can concentrate and meditate effectively, you know, we can experience that emotion. It doesn't, we can also be very concentrated and absorbed and happy when we're drawing, when we're writing, you know, when we're concentrated, we do feel happier. Do you experience that? Yeah, when we are really concentrated. That's how I got involved with meditation, because I was doing art. So ordinary happiness comes through the senses. Yeah, so we have to experience it. And what we can do is simplify and cultivate awareness of things that are there all the time that we can sort of make contact with. So a beautiful sky, being in green, pot plants on a block of flats, conversation. And that sort of, so we're starting to cultivate contentment when we find those very simple things that aren't dependent on someone providing it for us. So, one of the things about simplifying our expectations to be happy sort of helps us, well, gives us the time to concentrate, to meditate, to practice, you know, to do activities a bit more slowly so you become more absorbed. And we've said concentration's pleasant. And what we tend to do as humans is pleasant experiences make us want to do more. So we want more pleasant experiences. So, you know, it's a bit like it adds on to itself. So if we talk about deep levels of concentration or meditative absorption, we can experience happiness even when sense contacts are unpleasant. So, you know, a lot of the work on pain management is about that. Yeah, sort of coming right into the body, really focusing. It lessens our dependency on outside factors, so we start to learn experientially that we can make ourselves happy. We're not so dependent on outside things being right for us. So that ability to do that becomes more of our reality in comparison with the arguments we might be in, or the slights we might feel, rejections, things that are happening in the world. Our reality becomes more, our mind can deal with this, and we're cultivating our minds. And then when that aspect of us becomes more of a reality, we're then more able to view the things that we would have previously found upsetting, or very, very upsetting, which would throw us, we can start to view those things with compassion. It's a bit like creating the space. So, in conclusion, so we looked at the Western definition of happiness, the Western root of it, Eastern root, sukha, which means bliss. Yeah, I've looked at a little bit of the research, looked at some compassion and mindfulness practices that help cultivate our minds. We've looked at the second noble truth, that suffering, unhappiness, is product of craving or desire. And we've looked at what we can do. So, Buddhist teachers say that the wise seek happiness from the mind. So, the cultivation of the practices that we do for our minds are what leads to true happiness. Okay. So, any questions? Do you want to start with yours? It's a very difficult question. I hope I can answer it all right. Yeah, do you remember your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, do ask it again, because...
Okay, so what drives us to do things in life when the desire ceases?
Okay, so... So craving and desire will cease when you're enlightened. Yeah, we've got a long way to go. But what drives us is perhaps more the pleasant experience of moving forward and transcending ourselves. And certainly desire is a massive part of that. You know, we've got to want something to want to do it, otherwise we wouldn't do anything. So it's not something that's wrong, but it's something that, when it's frustrated, causes unhappiness. And those frustrations, they can come from inside, of course, but often they're from outside. Even they could be internal, but way back in our lives something happened. Yeah? So, yeah, we can learn to work with our minds so that we cope with things that disappoint us better.
So, kind of bettering yourself, inside bettering yourself.
Bettering yourself, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not dependent on external world. But the external world supports us enormously. You know, a massive part of our movement is the friendships we have. You know, so, you know, it would be hard for us to practice without friendships.
So are you saying that when you're enlightened, the desire will stop?
It does, yes.
Because
enlightenment is unconditioned. Yes, yeah? So it's outside space and time as we know it. Yeah. So an enlightened being, from what I understand, you know, is able to operate in the world, teach. You know, will be disappointed, but it won't be the craving or desire that is the cause of that.
If you desire to become enlightened, you never will become enlightened. Would you? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. How do you deal with that?
Oh, these are hard, aren't they? really good, yeah. If the desire is goal-orientated, no, you won't.
No.
You won't. Because part of all the practices, the mind-training practices, are that you're open to what happens and you work creatively with it. And a lovely definition of enlightenment is a continuous series of creative events. So your response is creative and, you know, in the moment and absolutely meshed with what has triggered it all the time. So, yes, so if you're goal-orientated, you're going to be frustrated because perhaps goal orientation is a desire to be somewhere, which you might want to do, but if it's frustrating the way you're getting there, it's not helpful.
Because I had a meditation once where I became really blissed out for about a minute or so, totally free of thoughts and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought to myself, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, this was good, that's the key, I thought. And it went away.
It's really interesting. Yeah, we can be in these states, and the thought, because our mind has become free of thoughts, the thought means we drop a level of absorption. It's like, you know, so, yeah. And it's really important to value and remember those experiences, because it's what keeps you doing it. I really admire people that, you know, have often, you know, had long struggles with meditation, you know, because they're so, they really want to, you know, excel in it. But they're not getting a lot of pleasant experiences, but they still have a determination to, this is helping me, I'll keep doing it. But if next time you sit and meditate and you are disappointed because you haven't gotten to that blissful state, it sort of...
Well, that's just the thing, I've been seeking it ever since.
Absolutely, I know what you mean.
If I stop seeking it, then it might arise at some point.
It's a bit like you've got to let go, yeah. That whole letting go liberation thing. Yeah, yeah. And it's hard, because they are very strong experiences. Mm. Let me just check. Oh, I've got plenty of time. Any more questions? Yes?
I wonder if we've got to the point where we see desire and craving as an inevitable part of life. Have you got any advice for how we can move to a point where that craving doesn't become a dominant aspect of the mind?
Well, what Buddhist teachers say is training the mind, and sort of become, you know, sort of cultivate simplicity, actually cultivate being in the moment, so mindfulness, because you probably experience that. Again, when you're concentrated, you're in the moment with what's happening. But you can be in the moment. You can sort of be aware and feeling inside your body. Often we don't, because our minds are somewhere else. So it just lessens very gradually. But it's just interesting that it's not the thing that gives us happiness. It's that little absence of a desire or craving. And it's one of the root Buddhist historically called the root poisons of human existence. They're the things that keep us going round and round on the wheel of life and death. But you know, it has to be natural, and we have to sort of balance things with lots more positive experiences. You know, so if we're feeling low and we take ourselves to the park, it can be helpful. You know, it's quite a... But if we're feeling low and eat lots of chocolate, it helps for a little while because you get a burst of serotonin, I think it is. But then we don't feel so well. So, yeah. So it's how we use our minds. Yes, that we're... Our minds... Mm-hmm. Because I don't know whether you saw the program on the Mumbai slums. There were three programs of like business entrepreneurs in the slums, and they were unbelievably poor and destitute. And a lot of them were recycling, and they'd found ways to recycle things or grow things. And there was one group growing, you know, a condiment sort of on the beach. They'd found a little spring, and they're growing it on the beach. And they sort of collect the plants and go and sell them and bring in a little bit of money into their community. And they had all these shacks up. And every couple of months, the authorities would come in and pull down all the shacks because they weren't supposed to be there. And by the end of the second night, they're all up again. And it was a bit like these things just balanced each other. But they were, you know, this was a way people, incredibly destitute people, had found a positive and ethical way to make some money. And they just knew that, they just believed in their vision so firmly that something like having everything razed to the ground didn't, stop them. They just had that belief that, they just keep going, they just bounce back again. And there are lots of examples like that. And these are people that, are just so poor you wouldn't believe.
But that's the desire to see them doing it again, right? Rebuilding. That's the desire.
Yeah, but a good habit, a good desire. Because they had to maintain themselves. We're not saying we shouldn't have desire. But moments of complete happiness, there isn't desire involved.
That's probably like flexibility though, isn't it? Like what you were saying about a happy person is someone who's flexible.
Yeah.
Rather than getting knocked down. If the shack gets knocked down, they get knocked down, but they don't.
They just bounce back. They sort of bounce back. But I suppose I'm illustrating that because of course we're dependent on safety, security, somewhere to sleep, somewhere safe, friends around. But even the people that don't have that can experience happiness. And they have to work really hard to do it, to even survive. But they can still experience happiness. Because of their states of mind. Yeah?
In modern life,
and then you next.
We own iPads, iPhones, or some of us do. We want holidays abroad, savings accounts. Is a person thinking along those lines just losing the plot? Or?
So we need things to exist, don't we? I mean, I work, I need those things. I haven't got an iPad yet because I can't afford it. I want more money.
Would you like
money? I would. No, some things help us be convenient, but, and effective and more efficient, don't they? But what happens with things like that? What happens with iPlayer? I had a son. I looked after him by myself, I was teaching full time, and I got everything done. Now I watch things on iPlayer, and I don't have enough time. Yeah, so those sort of things, they're wonderful entertainments, and they're good, but, it's guarding how much of these sorts of things we allow in. And again, that's about training the mind. Is this helpful? Is this helpful to my state of mind? Is listening to putting on the news when you wake up helpful to your state of mind for the day? Sometimes it's just too sad. You need to listen to it later when you feel a bit better.
I'm relatively new to this whole concept. So if I met you at an event and you had 30 seconds to tell me why I should get into it, in a vertical extent,
why? Okay, so why you should practice loving kind?
I'm sitting there, you're handing out the leaflets outside.
All right.
So I walk by there, no thank you.
Okay. Well, you can control your levels of happiness with the mind. And mind training is meditations on loving kindness and mindfulness. It's really simple, isn't it? And simplifying your life a bit. Yeah? Would you be convinced?
Maybe.
The thing is, the Buddha said, test things out. You must never take things on someone's work.
I'd be intrigued to learn more, maybe.
Okay, okay.
It did seem a bit... I'd want to know how, probably.
Yeah.
You just told me what it would do, but how it would...
Oh, how it... Well, it means you've got more control of your states of mind. That's what you're learning.
Mm. But then how do you achieve that?
Being in the present moment.
Yeah, and practicing certain practices.
I think as well, you've kind of got to be open to the idea as well, and I think that comes from yourself, because someone can tell you what it will do, but if you're not open to the idea yourself, because I know, for example, like my husband would never bother coming here because he's just not open to the idea, whereas I think if you are just willing to maybe see things slightly differently than you do at the moment, that it might take you in certain directions.
Yeah, there's some sort of readiness. And then some people, you know, experience all these things, have, you know, all these very good states of mind, and they live completely different lives. You know, it can happen, can't it? But yes, it's being open. But also, is this experience working for me? You test it out. Yeah? If it doesn't work for you, if you feel horrible and dreadful by the time you've finished, that's perhaps not the right thing.
Would you say it's realistic to kind of, you know, cultivate happiness and to try and train the mind through meditating and things like that in our kind of busy lifestyles, or do you have to kind of change and adapt to your lifestyle?
Well, my experience, yours too probably, is that when you start to do it, you find, you know, changes happen, and then you find you adapt your lifestyle. Yeah.
Like that you want to adapt your lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. It's, and again, that's where desire comes in, you know, in terms of a good habit, is you wanting to do something in order to do more of this good habit. Yeah.
So I kind of find I've been meditating up and on for the last year or two, and it's got to the point where work and just normal life stuff's getting in the way.
I know.
And you just kind of, you can't fit it in.
I know.
And the more you try, the more kind of barriers you come up against.
Yeah, it's really hard. And you know, it's hard to sort of just decide to work part-time, work less. Often that's what people end up doing.
So not wanting all those materialistic things.
Yeah. And it's about simplifying your life a bit. Yeah. But it is a conflict for people.
Mm. How do you stop the kind of search for happiness becoming a negative craving in itself?
Yeah, exactly. I suppose if you're meditating effectively, and also particularly loving kindness and compassion, you know, yes, you can meditate on it, but you've got to do it. Yeah, so those people that did 5 good deeds over the week, their happiness centre. So it's quite active, isn't it? Another regarding. So I think that would be how you would stop it becoming like an ego selfish craving. You sort of extend outside yourself. Because we can crave anything, we crave all those things.
Sorry, I'm just
round the corner. Oh, beg your pardon.
I just wondered, how much time do I need to devote to meditation each day? Because I'm kind of, it's really difficult to elbow it into my life. So kind of 10 minutes in the morning and then 15 minutes in the evening. Is that enough or is it?
It's better than nothing. Yes, it is. It is. But often, you know, if you spend 9 of that 10 minutes just relaxing and experiencing your body, and 1 minute of concentrating on your breath, that will have more of an effect as if you roll out of bed, you feel terrible, and do that. Yeah. So every bit makes a difference. Every bit. Yeah. Vajra Shaksu used to meditate on the tube. You know, when you first get, you sit there on the tube and meditate the whole time. Yeah. So it's finding those little times, but they've got to be appropriate to you. Yeah. Do you have a question?
I was just thinking of, we talk about happiness like we rarely say it, don't often say the real thing. We talked about having possessions and having money, and then also there's the other side of societies that don't have a lot of money. And London's not going to experience a Mumbai type of scenario, although I'm sure some people live in those conditions on our doorstep. For us to live is to earn and to buy a corner of the world to live in. But to do that, no one else waits for you. So, yeah, how do you wrestle the urgency of, like, a wildlife instinct to be better than your adversary? How do you play sport without wanting to beat the other person? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly.
You see what brings that? Yeah, I don't, how are you supposed
but
to...
But does that then make it a good habit? Hmm?
Sports, if you're you can see sports, sport as being, I want to be my best.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably what you're talking about. Like, mm-hmm. You live a life where you're being your best. And if everyone did it, I think people might be happy with it. As humans have always fought and been competitive to push the thing that's human forward.
Sure.
So, yeah, I know that desire to move forward isn't always a bad thing, but the idea of having to defeat your opponent, how do you get around that being, you know, because that ultimately ends up with aggression or death.
Yeah. I mean, that is where compassion...
How do you resolve
and
moving forward as a species when it means you having to defeat your brother for you to get your bowl, you know? Do you let that...
Well, people that are living in that situation, of course, most... That is how it's primal... things for existence, and if I don't have it and that person does, you know, I die. So it is an instinct to survive, isn't it? But, you know, we don't sort of quite have those conditions, and so it's about, well, you know, what is helpful for our state of minds, because we're always hearing about very rich, you know, people that have really attained a lot, actually being quite unhappy in themselves. You know, so I suppose it's getting that balance. Because, yeah, it's that moving forward, the desire to move forward and transcend. I suppose it's what you're transcending. You know, is that something you need to transcend or not? You know, how important is it? That might be different for different people.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just for us in a city, it's like getting on the tube. Sure. Not that I do that very often.
Sure.
I put my hand up, I admit that, I don't have to get on the tube much, but just to that rush, you get to a position where only one person can go on.
Sure.
What do you do? Do you be all like nice and Buddhist and let that person get on? Which I probably will do, even though I don't.
Yeah. Well, the perfect situation for practice.
Yes. Every instant is an instant for practice,
if you kept giving... You
don't negate yourself.
You
compassion.
You have to be selfish to some degree.
Well, you have to protect yourself.
Yeah.
You don't lose yourself.
But not at the
being
expense of
having
your
faith,
right?
Mm.
What's that big deal?
And also, do I really have to get onto that tiny spot in the train? Yes, I do. I'll be late. You can be nice about it. I smile.
Just the modern, our modern world makes us...
Oh, the thing really is give yourself more time. Then we're not in such a rush. I tell you what, my levels of irritation and anger really dropped when I gave up my car and I wasn't driving anymore.
It's creating the right circumstances in the first place.
Yeah, right conditions, yeah. Yeah, and as we practice, you know, that's when we start to change our conditions.
If you practice metta bhavana, is that like an essential practice? Because for me, it makes me very angry, and I leave the meditation in an angry state. Whereas if I do mindfulness of breathing, I naturally become more compassionate because I'm calmer. I don't need metta bhavana. Do you think that's a bad thing?
Think people you're not so irritated with. No, I'm being facetious. But what it's telling you something about yourself. Okay, I've suppressed these feelings, so what do I do with them? Meditation isn't, you know, we achieve happiness because we've trained our mind. The goal of meditation is not necessarily to be happy and completely compassionate, blah, blah, in the meditation. If we get very absorbed, we are, because that's how our mind works. But what it's really teaching us is how to work on our minds, work on what comes up. You know, what, oh my goodness, you know, I never knew I felt that about that person. What do I do about it? So it's you're learning about yourself. Yeah. But, and perhaps, yeah, sort of like start your metta-bhavana with mindfulness and, you know, and then just bring to mind somebody that, you know, you feel safe with and happy with.
The difficult question just jumps into my mind. I can't get rid of it.
Oh, they do! Don't they? I tell you what, I've had my strongest meditation experiences in that fourth stage of meditating on the difficult person. Because what you can do is you can trust that something flips at some point. So, we better finish after this question. Yeah? Yeah?
If I may share something related to this.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
It's not a question, so I don't...
Okay, no, that's great. It's a good way to end.
I used to hate metta-bhavana, and I'm still not very good at it. I had pretty much the same thing. So I just gave up for some time. Free of the various five parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that. So I gave up three of them. I just did two first of them.
First two stages, yeah.
Relatively easy.
Well, some people find...
After some time, yeah. Surprisingly, I noticed, I even didn't think about this, and I am quite angry guy. So after some time, I noticed that I actually can't do the other three stages.
That's why it is the way it is. Yeah, but some, yeah, and yeah, so it's like trusting in the practice, really.
Yeah, it's still not very easy.
No, a lot of people don't find it easy. Yeah, and some people find the first stage incredibly difficult. So, you know, what we suggest is start with your friend that you feel really comfortable and happy with. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. Brilliant questions. They are recorded, aren't they? Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day. Okay.